If any of you are alive and are in the proximity of the building or the place in which my funeral takes place, if my wishes are adhered to, you'll hear that song that we just sang again. That is my favorite song. I don't know if Matt knew that or not, but you get a bonus tonight. I'm not going to tell you what that is, but you're going to get a bonus for singing that song. I love that song. It means a great deal to me. I've sung that song for years, and usually if that song's not led at least a couple of times during the meeting, wherever I'm preaching, I usually lead it when I'm done at the end. So we've taken care of that. I've checked that one off the box, but I'm so glad that we sang that song tonight. And I appreciate very much all of you being here tonight. I've had a great day. I hope that you've had a good day. We got here a little earlier today and spent some time with Scott and Paula and Vivian. And I think we spent some time with Jordan. I think he was pulling in when we were pulling out. I think he's waiting until we left and then he came in. I think that's the way that happened. But anyway, of course, I'm kidding about that. But we had a great time, great meal, and just so good to spend some time with them. I told them a story. I'll share it with you very quickly. That, you know, preachers, when they go to meetings, they have to eat. That's the nature of, that's part of why we go, I think, you know. And I was in Montgomery years ago, staying with some folks there, and one night before we went to bed, the man of the house said, in the morning we're going to get up and go pick peas about 6, but you don't need to go. You just stay in bed. And I said, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to feel bad. I mean, they're going to pick peas. You know, they're 25 years older than me. I figure I need to go pick peas with them. Well, we went to pick peas for 3 hours that morning, from 6 to about 9:30, a little bit longer than that. And then we went to Shawnee's Breakfast Bar for breakfast. And I was hungry. I was tired. And I ate pretty much everything on the breakfast bar. I mean, literally everything they had, I think I about ate it. And we got back to the house about 11:30. And the man said, now, you're going to eat at 1. And I said, like, big meal? He said, yeah, some people want to take you out for lunch. And I said, okay. And I kind of sighed, and I didn't want to appear to be too unfriendly about the idea. So I said, okay. And so we went to eat lunch about 1, and I got back from lunch about 2:15. And I promise you what I'm about to tell you is the truth. He said, we're going to dinner at 4:30. And I said, well, okay, we're going. And, you know, you can't, you don't want to upset anybody. So I ate, and I ate barbecue at 4:30. And I got up that night, and that's all I'll tell you, but I didn't feel good. And I took more breaths that night, I'm confident, than any other time I preach. And we laugh about that now, I laugh about that. You know, but you know, folks, when you go to meetings, somebody's got to eat. And I figure if anybody can do it, I can do it. So I really enjoyed that. But I do appreciate all your hospitality. It's just been a pleasure to get to know you, and I look forward, if the Lord wills, to be with you several more nights. These things, at least for me, go by quickly, and it's always an honor and a privilege. And I know some of you, all of you have had a busy day. Many of you have worked. All of you have worked to some degree or another. I know you're tired, but yet you've made a decision, and the decision is to come here tonight, and you've come here to be edified. And I pray to be instructed in some way and to be helped and to be benefited spiritually. And so for that, you're to be commended. And I very much appreciate the fact that you've allowed me again to be a part of that. So thank you very much for being here. The lessons that I want to preach tomorrow night and the nights to follow, I think, are listed in the flyer that was made. And I hope that you'll make your plans to come back and be with us then. Well, tonight, I want to talk to you about the Word became flesh. I just want you to think about that for just a minute. The Word became flesh. That's about as unreasonable a statement. That makes very little sense that a Word could become flesh. In this case, the Word that has become flesh. It's not only is it unreasonable, it almost sounds impossible for our feeble minds. But when we're dealing with God's ability to do something for a specific purpose, and maybe for multiple purposes, it begins to make more sense. And let me suggest something as we begin to think about this. And I want to ask you to do something. As familiar as we are with God, the very concept of God, I believe, is difficult. It's difficult to define definitively. If I asked you, define God, how would you do that? You say, well, I've known about God all my life. Well, then how do you define God? I'll give you a second to think about it. And I'm going to tell you right now, it's very hard to do. I'm not sure we can define Him. And typically what we end up doing is we discuss or we mention attributes of God. God is love. Well, that's true. God is holy. God is eternal. All of those are attributes. That's not defining God. And I'm going to propose to you tonight that defining God is a very difficult thing. We talk about God all the time. We obey God and honor God and follow God. Yet it's hard for us to define God. And I'm going to suggest this, that should not destroy our faith or damage our faith. What it really should do, it should really challenge us to know more about Him. And it kind of goes back, and I promise you I'm going to get off this eventually, but it kind of goes back to yesterday and some of those lessons that we discussed yesterday that have to do with making ourselves better spiritually. I believe that is the ultimate objective that God wants. He's made us in His image, and He says to us, from the time you're born into the world, your objective is to become like Me. And that sometimes is a very difficult thing to do. But He wants us to know more about Him. And by knowing more about Him, then we can implement things about Him into our lives and become more like Him. And faith helps us do that. Faith is evidence that allows us to do that. But the whole idea of God becoming flesh clearly leaves questions. And I'm going to tell you tonight, you're probably going to leave here knowing less about it than you did before we started. And to that you're going, well then why don't we just go ahead and leave? Well, I'm going to make an attempt. I want to make an attempt to share some things with you. Not just from an instructional standpoint. Not just to say, I want you to consider these things. But I want us to talk about why these things are important. And I think they are important because there are implications to the fact that Jesus was God and He came in the flesh. Now, if I ask you tonight that we're going to talk about this, and I said, I want you to give me, I'll give you one guess as to what passage we're going to turn to, where would you say? Yep, John 1. So I want you to take your Bibles, and I want you to go to John 1, and we're going to look at several passages, some of which will be on the screen, not all, but some. And I want to approach this subject tonight kind of like a news story. When I was in high school, my English teacher, she was my favorite teacher. Well, other than my dad, I have to say that in case he hears about me talking about my other teacher that I love. I had my dad as a teacher. The biggest problem with that is I didn't know what to call him. I'd say, hey, and finally he'd respond to me. I didn't know if to call him Dad or Mr. Moore. I didn't know what to call him. He was a good teacher, but Ms. McLaughlin was a teacher that I loved. And believe it or not, one of my favorite things to do is to diagram sentences in English. I just love that. You know, some of you people are math whizzes. I don't even understand you. But when it comes to diagramming sentences, now I like to do that. And she taught me some things about not only English, but about journalism. And you're probably thinking, well, we've heard you talk. She didn't teach you much. Well, be that as it may, she taught me a few things in terms of journalism. And one of the things she taught me was, when you're talking about a story, when you're writing a story, think about it in terms of some questions that you want to ask. And those questions that we would ask were things like who, what, when, where, how, why. And she would tell me, if you'll get those questions down, you'll have a pretty good idea of what you're trying to accomplish. And I thought, as I thought about this lesson, I thought, well, those are some questions that at least help me package the approach that I want to take to what I think is a very hard subject. The Word became flesh. I mean, just thinking about it, a little bit kind of blows my mind. But I think if we think about it by answering these questions, and some of these questions I'm just going to pass over pretty quickly. I may show you a slide with a particular verse or set of verses, and I want you to think about it, but we're going to spend the majority of our time on the points that at least I want to call to your mind in a little bit greater way tonight. But I want to approach it in this kind of way. But let's look at this. Let me go back here. Let's go back and read the passage first. We need to do that. And the Word, this is verse 14 of John 1, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of Him and cried out, saying, this was He of whom I said, He who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace, for the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. This is an important passage for a number of reasons, and I want us to look at some things tonight. Let's talk about who. Who are we talking about? And again, to talk about God, and I know we talk about him all the time. We preach about him, we talk about him, we teach about him, and that's understandable. He is the focus. But when you stop and think about exactly who we're talking about, you can't grasp exactly who we're talking about. We accept God by faith, and so some of these concepts, some of these ideas are not easy. So in John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Most of us can quote that verse. Do you understand it? It's a little bit hard, but the Word is the expression, the expressed idea of God. And verse 14 of the same chapter says that this Word, this expressed idea of God, became flesh and dwelt among us. Now we're starting to get the picture. And we beheld now His glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So we do understand that this Word became flesh. I affirm tonight what many people deny, that Jesus came in the flesh. Atheists are going to deny it, obviously. Agnostics essentially deny it as well. Cultural Christians believe Jesus existed, and a lot of people may believe that he existed, but they believe that he was not God. He was a great teacher. He had many good things to say. He accomplished some good things, but he really wasn't God. And cultic Christians regard the Bible as true and Jesus as being God's spokesman, but stumble over the idea that the three personalities share one common deity. That's just something that they can't comprehend. Jehovah's Witnesses are like that. That's the idea that they believe. But I believe tonight that Jesus, the Word, God, did come in the flesh. And the reason I believe that is because Jesus himself would say that. In John 8, he said, Jesus said to them, most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Now, let me just tell you, just put that in your brain and let it roll around for a little bit. Before Abraham was, I am. He would go on to say in John 17, as he is getting ready to face one of the most difficult times of his life, if not the most difficult on earth, he says, and now, O Father, glorify me together with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world was. And what these passages show is a continuity of identity. Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. There's an eternal idea in that concept. And then in John 17, he says, I want to have this glory with you, which I had with you before the world was. There's this, he's on earth saying this. So there is an eternity, a before and after. And in time, while he's on earth, God is said to have become flesh. Well, now here's the difficulty. What happened? And a lot of people believe a lot of things about this. I believe what the Bible teaches is that deity and man came together. God took upon himself the very nature of man. And I'll just tell you that that's a difficult concept, I think, for us to grasp. But deity did not cease being deity when deity became a man. Let me try to illustrate. I thought about this and I thought, how can I illustrate for myself, first of all, and how can I illustrate for those whom I'm trying to make a point? How can I illustrate to kind of help us understand that? And here's an illustration that I like to use. Let's say you're the head of a company. And in order for you to understand and to get a grasp of what's going on under you, or those who are subordinate, those who are underneath you, those underlings, how do you understand what they are? Well, you may say, I want to go work in the warehouse. I want to go work in the office. I want to get out of my office, and I want to go see how the whole operation works. And I know that's not a real good illustration, but at least in my mind, what it says is, here is a person at the top, and we're dealing with all persons here, so the analogy falls at some point. But the idea is that the CEO decides to see how everyone who works for him and who is under him lives. But yet he doesn't give up who he is or who she is. So it's the idea of really the undercover boss kind of thing. It's the TV show, you know, where the boss goes undercover. Nobody really knows. Now I want you to look at Philippians 2. This is a passage that we go to. And I realize the illustration wanes in a lot of ways. But at least it kind of gets you thinking in those terms. Listen to Philippians 2. Paul would say, who being in the form of God did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. Paul says that Jesus emptied himself. A lot of people say, well, he emptied himself of deity. He was no longer deity. And I don't think that's what that passage is teaching us. I think he emptied himself. I think that is true. But Colossians, the second chapter in verse 9, tells us, for in him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. So my question is, of what did Jesus empty himself? Well, John 17 says, and now we've read this, and now, O Father, glorify me together with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world was. You might say, well, Kenny, what exactly are you getting at? Well, what's the point of all this? Well, I think this is the point. I think Jesus limited his divine power to submit to his Father's will. I don't think he gave up who he was. But he said, I'm going to limit myself. I'm going to empty myself in a sense. And I'm going to limit the use of this divine power because of what it is that I need to do. Jesus was God and he was man, and he did that simultaneously. And somebody said, well, then how do you reconcile some? How do you reconcile passages like James 1? 13 in Hebrews 4:15. One says God cannot be tempted, and the other says that he was tempted. How do you reconcile that? Well, in my feeble mind, in my limited academic mind, the way I resolve that is, he was God and he was man. He limited himself in some aspect, yet he was God at the same time. And so, that's my answer. He was God and he was man. We'll look at a little bit more about that idea in just a moment. When did it happen? Well, you're familiar with some of these. It happened at his birth. Matthew 1, verses 18 through 23 talked to us about the fact that when he came to earth, he was born. Look especially at verse 21. And she will bring forth a son. You shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. So all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, behold, the virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which is translated God with us. When did that take place? When did God become man? At his birth. He was born, and it had been prophesied that he would be born. Matthew 2 tells us that he would have been born in Bethlehem. That brought great consternation to Herod. He was deeply concerned about that, as he should have been. But again, the prophets were speaking about what was going to happen. And this again is evidence of who Jesus was. The fact that he was God and that he actually did come in the flesh. That he was born in Bethlehem and that he was God with us. He was Emmanuel. Well, get to another one. How did that happen? You know, we got the virgin birth. And we've got the angels appearing, and we've got, you know, business with Mary and the business with Joseph and the concern about that. And I'll just tell you, I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. If I'm thinking purely in terms of what happens on earth, it makes no sense. That can happen. But we're not talking about things that happen on earth. We're not talking about things that simply happen based upon what our understanding is. Spirit to flesh is a hard concept to realize. We're back to that spiritual business, into the fleshly business. That's just a hard concept for us. We are spirit. We are spiritual, but because we're not fully that way, it makes it difficult for us to understand. We can understand some of it. God's given us some things to help us understand it, but we don't have a full sense about that. As we said yesterday, when we're going to have a full sense of that is when we're like Him. We're going to be like God. And we'll understand that more. John would tell us that in 1 John. We're going to understand more about it when we're made to be, in a sense, like Him. Look at Nicodemus' words to Jesus in John. He said, "Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." And then Jesus responds, Nicodemus answered, saying to him, "How can these things be?" Jesus answered and said to him, "Are you the teacher of Israel and do not know these things? Most assuredly, I say to you," listen to what Jesus said, "we speak what we know and testify what we have seen, and you do not receive our witness. If I had told you earthly things and you did not believe, how will you believe if I tell you heavenly things? No one has ascended to heaven but he who came down from heaven, that is the Son of Man who is in heaven." And Jesus may have said, "And I am he." And I know that's a hard concept for you to understand, but you must understand that that happened. When the Jews heard that, this passage tells us in verse 18 of John 5, "Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God." And I can promise you this, for most of us anyway, that if we'd have been alive in the first century and a man kept running around going, "I am God," we would have probably said the same thing. You're kidding. Blasphemy. That's what they said. And I get it. I mean, it just doesn't make much sense until you understand that God could do those things, that Jesus could do those things, that ultimately the apostles and others could do those things, to say it makes perfect sense. So, how did it happen? I'm not altogether sure, but Jesus said, "I've been with him, and now I'm here." And in time, you're going to understand that. And so let's get to the final question. The why. This is important. This is where I want to spend the majority of our time. Here is the final question. Why did God do this? Well, the easy answer is, John 1 verse 18 says, "No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, He has declared Him." Jesus is the declaration of God. And He's the declaration to them first, to show them first. Man needed to see God. Just stop for a minute and ask yourself this question. You've never seen God. I've never seen God. And yet we're here tonight. We're not only here tonight, we were here yesterday. And most of us, many of us, have lived the majority of our lives expressing faith in something we've never even seen. That's crazy talk, isn't it? It just didn't make a lot of sense. So God declared, God said, "I'm going to send my Son," and He is going to be a declaration and an ability. These eyewitnesses would have seen that. Well, verse 18 of this same text says, "No one has seen God at any time." And yet, the passage also tells us that the Son has declared Him. I just want to talk to you for just a moment about this. The Son declared Him. He didn't declare the Son to me, nor did He declare the Son to you. He declared the Son to them. Just a point of reference. Anytime you study the Bible, this point is well taken in anything. When you study the Bible, when you have pronouns that are used, you must understand the antecedent of the pronoun. If I walked in here tonight and said, "Well, he was in a terrible wreck," you'd go, "Well, Kenny, who?" I said, "Well, that man." "Well, who?" "Well, he." "Well, he who?" I mean, it just makes no sense. And so when we understand the pronouns, it helps us understand what he's trying to say. The Son declared him. The Son declared God. Not to me, but to them. This was an explicit and a formal announcement. Jesus was, listen to this, Jesus was the explanation of God. How could they understand it? Those people on earth to whom Jesus declared himself, this was the best shot. This was the way they had some idea of who God is. And we haven't even seen him. God would say, and John would say, that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. This was God's way of declaring who the Son was. Well, I want to share in this passage in John 1, I think there's an idea of intimacy. And when I want to talk about this with you for just a few minutes, because this is the point to me. It's not the only point, but it is such a strong point. What God wanted when He sent His Son into the world is for us to be sure that even though we have not seen Him, we can be 100% sure that what we believe about Him is true. God came for intimacy. He had to be seen by human beings, otherwise our understanding would be limited. In John 20, remember, He came and met with the apostles, and they believed Thomas wasn't there. And eventually Thomas saw, and he said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." He's talking about us. He's talking about us. There is a progression here. That's the kind of thing I want you to understand. We never saw God. We never saw Jesus. We never saw a miracle. Not one. And yet, every single one of us who is a professed Christian would say, "I believe with all my heart that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." And people look at us and go, "Are you serious? You've never seen the man. You've never seen any of the apostles. You've never seen any miracle." And we'd say, "I have not." And people look at us and go, "You mean to tell me you've got faith in all that and you never saw any of that?" And here's my question: how can that be so? Well, it's so because we believe the testimony. And we believe the testimony because the testimony is overwhelming. Verse 16 says, "And of His fullness we," see there's pronoun, "we have all received." We who? I think John's talking about the apostles particularly. "We have seen that. And of His fullness we have all received, and grace for grace." I think verse 17 is an explanation of verse 16. Christ brought fullness. Look at this, verse 17. This is what I think he's talking about. The fullness is, "For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." Christ brought much more. Christ brought grace and truth. Remember the concept of spirit and truth? It was a fuller idea. That was the idea of true and that which is full. That's the idea here. What Christ did was He brought grace and truth. Yes, He brought law, but He extended that. He brought something greater than that. He brought law, grace, and truth. He brought the full extent, if you will, of the law. Well, look at this next idea. This idea of grace for grace. And I will tell you, as I've studied this, this gives me a little problem. If I ask you, "And of His fullness we have all received in grace for grace," what's He talking about? Well, we know what grace is. But I think this is a little harder concept to grasp because of how the words are translated. Some of your translations say, "grace in exchange for grace." Some may say, "grace as a substitute for grace." But what I think Jesus is saying is that of His fullness we have all received grace for grace. So you say, "Well, Kenny, now that's what it says. That's what it means." It's back, you know, back, I remember when I've been some of those, when I was a kid, I remember, you know, teacher getting a Bible and somebody said, "Well, what does that mean exactly?" "Well, it means what it says." That's kind of where I am in this subject. What does that mean? That means what it says. You know what that means. And then I thought about this, and I think here's the idea. Verse 14 says, we beheld His glory full of grace and truth. The eyewitnesses observed Jesus. They beheld Him. And I want you to think about this word. The literal word carries the idea of theater. Or as we said in Balnab, theater. That's a joke, by the way. I grew up in a little town. I didn't understand much about theater. But the idea is it connotes more than a casual glance. It involves careful scrutiny of what is before one to understand its significance. In other words, what he's saying here is that when the eyewitnesses saw who Jesus was, they didn't just say, okay, I'm convinced. They watched Him. They watched Him carefully. It wasn't just, okay, I think, you know, He did that miracle. I think we're good to go. I think I believe Him. No, no, no. They watched Him, not just one time, not just one event. They watched Him. And this passage that this same writer talks about in his epistle says that much. In 1 John 1, John would say this, that which was from the beginning. Yeah, that's a pretty easy concept to understand. Which we have heard. See, here's the pronouns. We have heard. We have seen, we have looked upon, and our hands have handled concerning what? The Word of life. Well, what about this word? The life was manifested. We have seen. We bear witness. And we declare to you. Not just one time. We continually declare. We saw Him. We saw Him. And we heard that which we have seen and heard, we declare to you. There's the idea. This earthly life was manifested, and we've seen and bear witness and declare that you, to you, that eternal life which was with the Father was manifested to us. You see that the transition that takes place? And the reason that to me this is powerful is because the Word became flesh is not just more Bible. It's not just another text. It is a text that says God actually sent God into the world to dwell among people. And John is saying, we saw Him. And not only did we see Him, but we heard Him. And not only did we hear Him, we touched Him. All of these things that have such great significance to us. I'll tell you what, if I saw someone, heard someone, and touched someone, you know what I'd say? He's real. And that's what they're trying to help us understand. That's what they're trying to help us see. So the idea is that there is a growing realization among the apostles and now among us that which we seen and heard, we declare to you that you also may have fellowship with us. How does that happen? How do we have fellowship? How do we share in what the apostles saw, heard, and felt? You believe it. You believe their testimony. And may I suggest this to us? This is part of the point that I want to make. If we believe this as strongly as I believe the apostles want us to see it, we can't just walk out of here and go, yeah, that was a pretty good lesson. If we really believe this, if this is why we believe, and I'm not suggesting that it's the only reason, but to me it's one of the most powerful evidences. Here were apostles that saw this. The evidence is plenty for us. What they did was they declared the fact that Jesus actually was who He said He was. And that's a powerful concept for me. So in a sense, Him coming is evidence to say, you can believe who I am. Let me make one final and critical, what I think is a critically important point. You might say, He came, but can He give me something practical? You know, people love practical preaching. As a matter of fact, sometimes I get tired of people, you know, well, you didn't know no practical application. How many times in prayers? Lord, we thank you for what we learned, and what's the next phrase out of the prayer's mouth? Help us to, everybody say it with me, apply it to our lives. Okay? Well, I do think that good preaching is applicable preaching. It's not, that's not the only thing it is, but that's certainly one of the great characteristics of it. Let's talk about that for just a minute. Listen to this. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Now, this is the last 2 minutes. This time to wake up. This is the practical application. Our high priest, who is God, sympathizes with our weaknesses. I don't care who you are. At some point in time in your life, when things are going south, so to speak, I hate to use that term in the south, but when things are going a way that you don't want them to go, most of us, if not all of us, have said to ourselves, God just doesn't understand. That's wrong. He does understand. He does. This is a double negative in essence. Who cannot sympathize? Yes, he does. He does sympathize. And yes, we do have a high priest. He was tempted just like we are. In all points yet without sin. God knows how we have been tested. God knows how we have been tempted. And I'll just tell you, again, that's kind of hard for me to wrap my mind around. But what if he'd been tempted like me and tested like me and failed like me? You ever thought about that? Let me ask you a question. You ever thought about this? You ever said to yourself, he was God? He couldn't sin if he wanted to. That's wrong. He had the ability to sin. Listen, when we say he lived a perfect life, let me state it differently. He chose. He decided to live a perfect life. He lived a perfect life. Let me say it again. He lived a perfect life. He had no sin. Not because he couldn't, but because he chose to do that. Now, what does that tell you and me? What a better situation for a Christian than to know God knows, that he cares, that he knows exactly what you're going through, and when he went through it, he didn't sin. And what he wants you to do is to not sin either. Matter of fact, he says, I want you to be like me. And you say, well, Kenny, that's a tough order. That's right. Kenny, he doesn't expect me to live perfectly. That's right. But how many people use that as an excuse to say, well, he doesn't want me to live perfectly? That's right. But he wants you to try and live perfectly. He knows, he cares, and he acts. Now, that's a segue into tomorrow night's lesson. He acts. How does he act? When we talk about tomorrow night, when we talk about providence and prayer and faith, I want to reach a conclusion that I've reached. I want to share it with you, and I want you to see if you agree with it. But I can promise you, he understands what you're going through. And one of the great benefits to the fact that he came in the flesh is he understands. He does a lot of things. Him coming in the flesh was a declaration. Him coming in the flesh said that I understand what you're going through. And him coming in the flesh said, I'm willing to be the sacrifice for your sins. And like I said yesterday, folks, most people, that just goes, if they heard that just go in one ear and out the other. Here's the difference. Here's the difference in a person who wants to please God. When they hear that, that registers with them. They're not hearing it academically. They're hearing it intellectually, and they're hearing it emotionally, and they're hearing it, as we talked about, they're hearing it spiritually. And they're saying, I want to take part in that. I want to have that. So here's my question to you tonight. Do you want to have that? Does all of that, is that have any meaning to you, or is that just preacher talk? You know, Kenny, he's preached for about 30, 40 minutes, and that's good preacher talk, but you know, that doesn't have anything to do with me. You couldn't be more wrong. It has everything to do with you. But it has more to do with if you'll choose to do something about it. So that's what we want to encourage you to do. Understand the value of Him coming, and understand, though, what it ultimately can mean for you, and take advantage of that by responding to the invitation of Christ. Do that now, please, as we stand and as we sing.